welcome all of you to this lecture this morning. I am delighted that you're able to make it. We got some apologies, and as you know, we have been having for the past 2 years lectures occasionally, and we're so blessed today to have another one and to find two very bright young men to lead us in the lecture today. The great English pundit and critic Samuel Johnson said, "A leader is a man who bears in his life both the most tangible and intangible qualities of heart and mind and flesh." He goes on to say, "Best we study these well." And C.S. Lewis was one of those leaders and intellectual giants of the 20th century, and arguably one of the most influential writers of his day. C.S. Lewis wrote more than 30 books, allowing him to reach a vast audience, and his works continue to attract thousands of new readers every year. Today we will delve into one of his books, The Abolition of Man, and we are indeed thankful to Reverend Jim Hagan of Georgetown University, and I'd say to not only the ACNA but also Christ the King, because he's always with us. I thank him for making contact with the two experts in the study of C.S. Lewis. We are grateful to Mr. Tim Schneider and to the Reverend Dr. Matthew Wilcoxon for taking time from their very busy schedules to present the lecture this morning, the title, "Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis and the Task of the Modern Educator." So do please help me to welcome them to All Angels as they present this lecture to us.
Well, thank you all. I just thought I would start by bringing you greetings in the Lord from the Church of the Resurrection on Capitol Hill. We are really excited to have some growing connection to those of you from Christ the King in Georgetown and also here at All Angels. So thank you, Father Carlton, for warmly welcoming us in. We are an Anglican church, Church of the Resurrection. We are kind of like your little brother, your dirty little brother. That you were raised in these. You're continuing Anglicans. You guys have been Anglicans for a long time, and we're kind of new, and we've been learning this Anglicanism thing. And so it's really an honor that you'd kind of let us in to your lives a little bit. So things on Capitol Hill are great. It's good to see the way the Lord is using our church and others to reach people there. And it's great to do this kind of thing with you. I think the way this came about was Jim and Tim and myself, we were all at Christ the King. We have been working on starting a ministry, a new type of ministry to students at Georgetown University. And so Father Carlton allowed us to meet there, and we were reading The Abolition of Man with some students and other people that are helping us get this new thing started. And I believe it was Dr. Macklin was there. She came in and said, "You guys got to get out of here. We're having a lunch." And I was like, "Who is this lady?" But apparently she found our discussion that she overheard interesting, and so recommended this to Father Carlton. So Tim and I, we're an odd couple. He's really handsome, and I'm not. And he's a Baptist, and I'm an Anglican. But we're doing this together because we've been working on starting something called the Augustine Center. And the Augustine Center is a Christian study center at Georgetown University. It's this huge, gargantuan task of reaching that community and changing that community and ministering not only to individuals, those are important, but also the very university and the core of its calling. We want to do that at Jerusalem. So we have this big vision, and we're two guys trying to do it together. And so the C.S. Lewis Abolition of Man book is really helpful in this way because it is core to what we're trying to do. It tells us some really important things about why this, what we're trying to do, is important and how it ought to be done. And so I think it's great. And so we're looking forward to working through it with you here this morning. Right before I call Tim up, just show of hands, who's read the book? No shame if you haven't. Who's read the book? Okay. So there are some people that here that haven't read the book. When I first got really serious about theology and thinking about my faith was late in high school, and I got really into C.S. Lewis, and I read so many of his books, and I found them accessible and engaging. This one, I had no idea what it was saying, and I thought, that's a weird book where he talks about the green book. And so it kind of sat on my shelf, not this literal copy, but for years, and I went through studying theology and reading philosophy and growing, and then I came back to this book just a couple of years ago, and I read it again, and I understood it, and I said to myself, this is probably his most important, prescient book that he's written, and I think it's really important for us. So what we're going to do today is Tim's going to kind of lay out the argument of the book for you first. Now, that will be helpful. You follow along, pay attention, even if you haven't read the book. What it will do is help you when you go back and read it, because you should read this. It's only like 80 pages. Pick this up and read it, and it'll help you. You'll kind of have an idea of what Lewis is doing, and I'm going to come in and then relate it to some of the things going on in the realm of student life today and related to culture and what we want to do with the Augustine Center. And then we'll have plenty of time for questions, and so that's what we're going to do. Let's have Tim come up.
Thank you again for the invitation. It's a humbling privilege to be here with you. The title of this work, as Matt mentioned, is The Abolition of Man. It describes what happens to the essence of a person when truth is distorted and mankind does not relate to truth as God intended. In this work, Lewis explains how the core of man is hollowed out by distortions of the truth. These distortions are the content of an improper education, which shrivels the soul in two significant ways. The impact upon one's soul is evidenced by the inability to recognize what is beautiful and what is abhorrent. More often than not, the pupil is unaware of the loss of this recognition. Lewis contends if a person does not know what to embrace and what to shun, the makeup of that person's soul is not correctly ordered according to the design crafted by the Creator. As a result, one does not experience flourishing in his or her life. Flourishing in one's life is brought about by wise decision-making, self-discipline, self-sacrifice, dynamism, creativity. These are the traits many wish to see in their fellow citizens. But improper education has not been cultivating them in young minds for quite some time. The effect has been disastrous. Lewis states, quote, "In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors among us." Close quote. We see this quite clearly in our time. Our political, academic, and cultural leaders do not have the resources to grapple properly with issues such as sexual assault, the failing public school system, the abuse of opioids, and many other crises. Now, before we look at the book in depth, keep in mind that Lewis wrote the book not as an argument for belief in God, but as an argument for the belief in natural law or practical reason, which we as Christians would say was created by God. So how does Lewis open the book? He opens by illustrating the importance of the precision of truth and what happens when there is imprecision and its impact upon a young mind. This helps us much in understanding how we arrived at this perilous moment in our nation's history. Lewis speaks of a passage from an elementary textbook. As a matter of respect, he refrains from using the true names and assigns them fictitious names, Gaius and Titius. The passage begins, quote, "In their second chapter, Gaius and Titius quote the well-known story of Coleridge at the waterfall. You may remember that there are two tourists present. The one called it sublime. The other tourist called it pretty. And that Coleridge mentally endorsed the first judgment and rejected the second with disgust. Gaius and Titius comment as follows. Quote, when the man said, this is sublime, referring to the waterfall, he appeared to be making a remark about it. Actually, again, this is Gaius and Titius in their book, they say he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was really, I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime. Or to put it more succinctly, I have sublime feelings. That was from the textbook. Now this is Lewis commenting on their analysis. Here are a good many deep questions settled in a pretty summary fashion, but the authors are not finished yet. They add, quote, this confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something outside of ourselves, when in actuality, we are saying something about our own feelings. Close quote. So this is the crux of the problem with this portion of the textbook, according to Lewis. The two authors and their contention that they are not seeing what's going on in the soul of the person calling the waterfall sublime. They are denying the observer of his intentions. The observer is communicating for the purpose of expressing his view about a reality outside his person. He is not communicating, as Gaius and Titius claim, he is not communicating for the purpose of expressing what is taking place inside his person. The distinction might be viewed as nitpicking, but Lewis explains the importance of the distinction. Lewis writes, quote, the schoolboy who reads this passage in the Green Book will believe two propositions. Firstly, that all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And secondly, that all such statements are unimportant. It is true that Gaius and Titius have said neither of these things in so many words. They have treated only one particular predicate of value, that phrase is sublime, referring to the waterfall, as a word descriptive of the speaker's emotions. The pupils, however, are left to do for themselves the work of extending the same treatment to all predicates of value. Close quote. This opening example from the book illustrates how a seeming small distortion of the truth assists in making one's soul disordered. In this case, the processing of an external reality and the expression of the impact of that reality is upended. According to Gaius and Titius, when we comment about something outside of ourselves, we are actually commenting about something inside of ourselves. And Lewis argues that pupils will apply this interpretive method to all statements expressing a viewpoint, whether they have been instructed to do so or not. In the following paragraphs, after this explanation and critique of Gaius and Titius's textbook, Lewis provides more examples of shoddy literary criticism that other authors exemplify. He then states, quote, whether these educators know it or not, they are teaching philosophy, not grammar. They are cutting down jungles, not irrigating deserts. Lewis contends, quote, "The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments," close quote. Now, why is this crucial? Well, Lewis continues, quote, "By starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes," close quote. The sensibility of our pupils. What does this sensibility look like? I mean, in our current age, sensibility could be defined 10 different ways by 5 different people. It seems to be a word loaded with subjectivism. Lewis informs us it is not. He writes, quote, "Certain responses could be more just or ordinate or appropriate to the waterfall than others. The man who called the waterfall sublime was not intending to simply describe his emotions about it. He was also claiming that the subject was one which merited those emotions." Lewis then continues, quote, "St. Augustine defines virtue as ordo amoris, or amorous, the ordinate condition of affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it. When the age for reflective thought comes, the pupil, who has been trained in ordinate affections or just sentiments, will easily find the principles, the first principles, in ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in that science. Plato before him had said the same. The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred of those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. In the Republic, the well-nurtured youth is one who would see most clearly whatever was amiss in ill-made works of man or ill-grown works of nature, and with a just distaste would blame and hate the ugly even from his earliest years, and would give delighted praise to beauty, receiving it into his soul and being nourished by it, so that he becomes a man of gentle heart." Closed quote. This is the great deficiency of our day, is it not? In New York, when Governor Cuomo signed the bill permitting the killing of a child after the 24th week of pregnancy, that which was abhorrent, or that which is abhorrent, was cheered. When it came to light, Vice President Pence does not dine with a woman alone, nor attend events where alcohol is being served without his wife also present. That which is prudent was mocked. In these two examples, just sentiments, or the proper way to respond, has not been taught. Therefore, it has not been exhibited. So where does one find the truth? Or, more simply, what is this truth that an educator, or a pastor, or a parent should teach? Lewis writes of the Ruta, which in early Hinduism was a reflection of what was revealed in the cosmic order, the moral virtues, and the ceremonial of the temple. He continues, quote, relating to another culture, "The Chinese also speak of a great thing, the greatest thing, called the Ta. It is also the way which every man should tread in imitation of that cosmic and supercosmic progression, conforming all activities to that great exemplar. The Tao is harmony with nature." Lewis continues, quote, "The realities found in the Rita and the Tao and in other forms, Platonic, Aristotelian, Stoic, Christian, and Oriental alike, I shall henceforth refer to for brevity simply as the Tao. The doctrine of objective value is common to all of them. The belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false. To the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are." Those who know the Tao can hold that to call children delightful or old men venerable is not simply to record a psychological fact about our own parental or filial emotions at the moment, but to recognize a quality which demands a certain response from us, whether we make it or not. And this is Lewis speaking. I love children. I have a five-year-old. Lewis says, I myself do not enjoy the society of small children. Because I speak from within the Tao, I recognize this as a defect in myself. Just as a man may have to recognize that he is tone deaf or colorblind, and because our approvals and disapprovals are thus recognitions of objective values or responses to an objective order, no emotion in itself is a judgment. In that sense, all emotions and sentiments are illogical, but they can be reasonable or unreasonable as they conform to reason with a capital R. Or they may fail to conform to reason. Here's Lewis's zinger at the end of this thought. The heart never takes the place of the head, but it can and should obey it. Close quote. Now, Lewis is coming to the end and he brings the whole issue into focus by saying this, quote, hence the educational problem is wholly different according to where you stand, whether you stand within the Tao or without the Tao. For those within, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not. So he's not advocating for a pragmatist approach. Whether it's happening or not, whether it's true or not, those responses should be taking place. He continues, quote, the very nature of man consists of recognizing what is logical and what is illogical. Those without the Tao, if they are logical, though, must regard all sentiments as equally non-rational. And we'll explain that in a moment. As a result, they must decide to remove all sentiments as far as possible from the pupil's mind, or else to encourage some sentiments for reasons that have nothing to do with their intrinsic justness or ordinancy. Now, in other words, for the person who rejects the Tao, for the person who rejects natural law, if that person makes a moral decision, then the reason for that decision and the accompanying sentiments must not be in accordance with the Tao. Let's take a look at an example. If we are going to save a baby's life in the womb, the reason would not come from the Tao or natural law. The baby's life would not be saved because it is life given by God, because it should be respected, or because it has priceless value. No, the baby is saved for other reasons. There is an action, but there are not just or ordinate affections associated with the moral action. The baby is saved because it is the right time in my life, because I have enough money to afford my current lifestyle and the needs of my future child, or because I now have a person in my life who will support me and help me with the raising of my child. This is what it comes down to, Lewis writes. Quote, were the old education initiated, the new merely conditions. The old dealt with its pupils as grown birds deal with young birds when they teach them to fly. The new deals with them more as a poultry keeper deals with young birds, making them into this or that for purposes of which the birds know nothing. In a word, the old was a kind of propagation, men transmitting manhood to men. The new is merely propaganda. Close quote. Now moving on to chapter 2. At the beginning of chapter 2, Lewis provides the devastating effects of this new education. He writes, quote, the practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book Remember, the Green Book is the textbook written by Gaius Antinous. The practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book must be the destruction of the society which accepts it. Powerful words for us in the 21st century. Maybe to our ears this comes across a little extreme. Lewis might be accused of fear-mongering. Really? The destruction of society? Just by switching some things around and not putting right emotions with the right situation or for the right reasons? But is societal destruction imminent when truth is handled so carelessly? Are people being misled regarding the nature of emotions and the proper use of them? Well, we've already looked at the current disposition toward the unborn by our culture. If neglect is shown toward a person at the beginning of his or her life, is it not inevitable that the same neglect will be shown to the person at the end of their life? This is the imminent destruction of life. If people are not taught just sentiments, if they're not taught how their hearts should respond in certain situations, then what is guiding their decision-making? I would contend circumstances, opportunities are. Think of phrases like, do what feels good, or do what you think is right. These are instincts that pervade our society. Indeed, they have invaded the halls of our government. We observe many decisions made based upon circumstances or opportunities whereby politicians seek to maintain power or expand power. This is imminent destruction of government. And for the sake of time, we will not touch upon the destruction of society, but a weekly reading of the newspaper provides plenty of examples where a corrosive friction exists between significant segments of our society. Later in chapter 2, Lewis explains the self-authenticating nature of the town. He does so by explaining how the teachers of the new education, or the innovator, uses the portions of the Tao when it suits them for their purposes. The innovator is quick to dismiss the Tao, but has no issue borrowing from it when he desires. But Lewis argues this cannot be done. Everything in the Tao, or natural law, is valid, or none of it is valid. One cannot discard some aspects of it and retain others. For instance, the atheist adheres to the Tao when he declares murder a moral wrong. He considers this a correct portion of the Tao, but considers incorrect the belief in a superior being. Both truths come from the Tao. Lewis states, however, it is an impossibility to dismiss one and accept the other. Both are true, or both are false. Lewis ends this section with great force of argument. Quote, the Tao, or in our current day, natural law or traditional morality, is the sole source of all value judgments. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. If any value is retained, it is retained. The effort to refute it and raise a new system of value in its place is self-contradictory. There has never been and never will be a radically new judgment of value in the history of the world. What purport to be new systems or ideologies all consist of fragments from the Tao itself. The rebellion of these new ideologies against the Tao is a rebellion of the branches against the tree. If the rebels could succeed, they would find that they have destroyed themselves. The human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of imagining a new primary color, or indeed of creating a new sun or a new sky for it to move in. This time, Matt will finish us up.
All right. Thanks, Tim.